Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by Gatehouse Capitol correspondent John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hi, Zach.
Impeachment is on the minds of many Americans these days, including many Floridians. We'll talk about the Florida reaction to impeachment as the public testimony phase kicked off Wednesday. More revelations about Governor Ron DeSantis' connection to a Ukrainian-born man mixed up in the impeachment drama, and a hotly debated abortion bill that had a hearing in the Florida Senate this week. But first, you all know what that music means. It's time for our Pick a Number segment. John, I won't impeach you if you didn't bring a number today, but I will be disappointed.
I see what you did there. Well, I'm back with another number, but this one is heading toward the stratosphere this week. 543.2 million.
What was that again? I lost.
Yeah, it's complicated. 543.2
million. 0.2
million.
And I thought I had a big number today, but you just blew me out of the water. 543.2 million. As George Bennett used to say, John with the curve buster.
Yeah.
My number today is 824,000. So just shy of a million there.
We're both getting up there.
Yeah. Big numbers this week. All right. We'll write those numbers down, folks. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics at the end of the show. Well, the impeachment drama kicked into high gear this week as public testimony began. On Wednesday, the House Intelligence Committee questioned William Taylor, the acting U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, and George Kent, the deputy assistant secretary at the State Department overseeing European and Eurasian affairs. This was a historic hearing, the first public impeachment hearing since Bill Clinton's presidency more than two decades ago. And it's a make or break period where Democrats must make their case that impeachment is warranted. And many Republicans are trying hard to undercut the case for impeachment. Florida lawmakers are in the thick of it. The only Floridian who sits on the Intelligence Committee is Orlando Democrat Val Demings. Her congressional Twitter account tweeted an exchange she had with Kent and Taylor in which she asked them about Rudy Giuliani and his work in Ukraine on behalf of President Donald Trump. Here's a clip of that exchange.
Was Mr. Giuliani promoting U.S. national interests or policy in Ukraine, Ambassador?
I don't think so, ma'am.
Mr. Kent?
No, he was not.
What interest do you believe he was promoting, Mr. Kent?
I believe he was looking to dig up political dirt against a potential rival in the next election cycle.
Ambassador Taylor, what interest do you believe he was promoting?
I agree with Mr. Kent.
So that's Florida Congresswoman Val Demings trying to get at the crux of the impeachment case, and that is the accusation that Trump leveraged U.S. foreign aid to Ukraine in order to get them to dig up dirt on Joe Biden and his son. Meanwhile, Republicans slammed the proceedings as unfair and unwarranted. Congressman Matt Gaetz, a well-known Trump defender from the Florida Panhandle, pretty much live tweeted throughout the hearing. In one tweet, he took aim at Kent, calling him, quote, a permanent Washington member. I think that's a euphemism for the deep state. Congressman Greg Stube, a Republican from Sarasota County, tweeted out a clip during the hearing yesterday of an appearance that he made on Fox Business. Here's what Stube had to say about impeachment.
Well, and you have witnesses who obviously have their own motives as to why they're doing testimony. And then we're moving to this public phase. But the people that are testifying in the public phase have already testified behind closed doors. So you have the Democratic leadership and Adam Schiff deciding, cherry picking who they want to bring out and have the public hear from, not the people who are exculpatory evidence as it relates to the president and doing evidence as it relates to positive things for the president.
So there you have Stube accusing Democrats of cherry-picking witnesses who fit their narrative. Stube serves on the Judiciary Committee, which is the first stop for articles of impeachment. John, it seems like the battle lines are pretty well established here. Most Republicans have dug in hard against impeachment. Do you think this phase of public testimony can have an impact on GOP lawmakers, or do you think it could change public opinion, which is pretty evenly split on impeachment right now?
Well, it sure does seem pretty divided. Florida, like much of America, seems to be split into rival camps. Those who think the president has committed a high crime that is worthy of his being thrown out of office, and the other side being those who see Democrats allied with the deep state of political insiders who want rid of Trump because he's such a disruptor. But I was looking back at national polls and going back at least 2 months now, pretty consistently, it seems that about 10% more Americans are in favor of the inquiry going forward, and a rising number, although, you know, still in the single digit percentages, say that the president should be removed from office. At least that's the margin in the single digits between those who think he should be removed, or, you know, that this should be left alone. But, you know, in the biggest swing state, Florida, there are still pockets where apparently Trump can do no wrong. You remember Congressman Francis Rooney, the two-term Naples Republican, who last month he made news by saying he was skeptical of Trump's July call with the Ukrainian president, which is at the heart of this inquiry, and that Rooney wanted more information to come from the House Democrats impeachment inquiry. Well, at that time, he was one of the only Republicans to make such a statement, and right away, he also announced that he was not running for re-election. Well, just last week, one of the leading candidates to replace him in Southwest Florida announced his candidacy. That's State Rep Dane Eagles from Southwest Florida. And in his 2-minute announcement video, he mentioned Trump or the president 8 times. And he blasted what he called the far left, the media, and even some in our own Republican Party for damaging our values and the president. So passions are clearly high, but these days of hearings could ultimately change some opinions, I guess, either way, with more Floridians ready to see Trump go and maybe some thinking the Democrats are just out to get him. We don't know at this juncture just how this is going to play out, but we have a couple of weeks of unfolding drama here to watch and watch those favorability numbers change, maybe.
Yeah, I think the point you're making about the congressional race that's shaping up down in Southwest Florida and the Naples and Fort Myers area, with those candidates really hugging Trump closely, sort of illustrates that the vast majority of the GOP base is in no mood to hear that Trump did anything wrong. And, you know, I was at a Sarasota Republican Party meeting last night for an unrelated story, and you know, one of the opening speakers was talking about how this is a coup and about how, you know, Republicans need to rally around Trump, and that look how much he's done for the country over the last few years, and challenging them to say, what have you done for him? So, you know, it was very anti-impeachment at that meeting. I don't think the base is going to budge too much unless there's a real bombshell revelation here. But, you know, the independents are a huge part of this country, and if you lose some Republicans a majority of independents, you know, that could start to budge some people who have a lot of independents in their districts. So we'll see. I mean, a big question is how many people have watched these hearings. I mean, I was watching them on the computer, live streaming it yesterday. But I really wonder exactly how many people have tuned into this. You know, there's been a lot of talk about how during Watergate there was only so many channels on TV. You know, the hearings were played on all of them, and that it was more ubiquitous the Watergate hearings were on TV, and now people have so many different channels and so many different places to get their news. What do you think, John? I mean, do you think that, would you expect that a lot of people would tune into this here, that there's enough public interest? I guess we'll have to sort of wait and see what the viewership was for some of this, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a daytime TV drama, which, you know, doesn't work with most people's work schedules. And you also have a situation, perhaps in contrast to what Watergate was like, you have a media atmosphere right now that, well, so many media companies are somewhat diminished from what they were, you know, certainly 45 years ago during the Watergate era. And however, there are more opportunities to look at more outlets. Now, media has become much more polarized, too. So that contributes to people being able to find their corner of the world to hear an echo of what they believe in. And, you know, that may be something, too. But I think that that echo that you get from how the media covers this event, too, that eventually does start shading public opinion. I think people will be following this a little bit more as to, you know, what they're reading or hearing about in, you know, highlights of the day's hearings, as opposed to really watching them themselves and drawing their own conclusions based on what they see.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point. I mean, it's daytime TV. Most people are working, but I guess now you can stream things. You can listen to them, you know, on the internet radio or whatever while you go about your work. So it'll be interesting. I'd love to see some research on how many people say they actually have paid attention to this. Well, one of the players in the impeachment drama is Lev Parnas, a Ukrainian-born businessman who was indicted recently on campaign finance charges. Parnas helped Rudy Giuliani make connections in Ukraine and has become a central figure in the impeachment drama. Parnas also has ties to Governor Ron DeSantis. He and a business associate donated $50,000 to DeSantis' campaign and were front and center during the governor's inauguration ceremony. DeSantis has admitted to knowing Parnas, but recently has refused to discuss the relationship any further. And a big question is whether Parnas sought to benefit from the relationship somehow. Well, Politico reported this week that there was a meeting set up between Parnas and DeSantis in Palm Beach after DeSantis won the governor's race. DeSantis' office said that, quote, no substantive meeting ended up actually occurring. But it does raise questions about whether the two men were closer than DeSantis is letting on and whether there's more to the story. John, this seems to be a story that DeSantis just can't seem to shake, and it's fascinating because of Parnas' connection to this impeachment inquiry. What do you make of this latest development about a scheduled meeting after the governor's inauguration?
Yeah, Parnas is the ultimate Florida man by way of Ukraine. He's a Boca Raton resident who the governor, he won't say much about, but Parnas keeps popping up, Zelig-like, you know, if that's okay to make a Woody Allen movie reference. He's in various places and in various reporting about the early days of the DeSantis leadership. Now, you know, remember, another story was that Parnas sought a role on one of DeSantis's transition teams that were set up to help the governor get ready to take office. And of course, DeSantis chose to give back the money that his campaign had received from a company that Parnas was involved with after he was charged with making illegal contributions to members of Congress. DeSantis now is blaming Republican strategist Susie Wiles for arranging this Palm Beach meeting, which she denies. And of course, we've earlier mentioned on this podcast how she's been jettisoned from both the DeSantis and Trump orbits due to a falling out with the governor. But Parnas doesn't seem to disappear. And the fact that he got a mention in the opening day of the impeachment inquiry and seems willing to comply with the House Intelligence Committee and its inquiry of Trump, you know, he's been arrested after all for those campaign finance charges. So he may be willing to speak in exchange for some favorable sentencing considerations. It basically means that Parnas and his DeSantis connection may wind up getting even more attention nationally. DeSantis, as we sure know, is a true Trump loyalist. But on this, I think the governor would rather stay out of the impeachment inquiry.
What do you think about how DeSantis has handled this story? I mean, he's said a few things about Parnas, but recently when asked about it, he's basically said, well, that's all I'm going to say about this. I mean, yeah. Do you think there's things keep dripping out. Can he just, do you think that the governor looks good when he says, well, I'm not going to say anything anymore about this?
Yeah, I know. He's taken basically just the stiff arming tactic, you know, that he's that's it. Nothing more to say about it. And I don't know.
You know, about it. I mean, we keep finding out that there's more to the story. I mean, doesn't it make sense to just kind of lay out every interaction that he had? Or, I mean, if you don't do that, people are going to wonder, well, what else is out there? I mean,
right.
And then we keep finding that there was meetings and other things going on, it makes people wonder, well, what are you hiding?
Yeah. He does seem, the governor does seem to be concerned about like fully addressing this, you know, the idea of, you know, holding some kind of news conference or something like that to sort of lay out his relationship with Parnas and draw some distance. That may be in his favor, but I suppose he's looking at it too as why shine that light? That will make it a longer news story that requires more dissection. So the idea of just saying, you know, that's all I know and that's all I can say about it, that may be enough. You know, it's funny, the ubiquity of Parnas is remarkable because accompanying that Politico story that smartly laid out the Parnas and DeSantis potential meeting in Palm Beach, of an Associated Press photograph that accompanied it had Parnas at a rope line event around the time of the inauguration. And he's standing, Parnas is standing, smiling at a woman holding a photograph of DeSantis's first grade class in Dunedin, where he went to school. And it just so happened that that woman was familiar to me because we had met her, myself and another Gatehouse reporter, at the time of the inauguration, where her husband was basically shopping the story around, like, hey, you want to meet my wife? She was the new governor's first grade teacher. So it wound up being a Gatehouse, part of a Gatehouse inaugural coverage story. But there was Parnas later at some event standing right next to this woman. So, he's just like a random face in the crowd. But as we're starting to learn about DeSantis, I guess, he was more than that.
That's pretty funny. So somebody from DeSantis's first grade class is also trying to parlay.
Implicated.
Not just Parnas. Everybody likes to be close to power. And
evidently.
And talk about their relationship with the governor. Well, it certainly seems like a story that's not going away, despite the governor not wanting to talk about it. And so we'll see what else comes out. Well, as DeSantis continues to face heat over this Parnas connection, the legislature is going about their business and hearing bills during pre-session committee weeks. This week, a Senate committee held a hearing on an abortion bill that requires women 18 and under to get parental consent or a judge's approval before getting an abortion. John, you were in the committee room covering that hearing. What stuck out to you?
Yeah, well, in this case, Senate Democrats were prepared to fight against this abortion bill this week when it came through. They arrived with 16 amendments that were all defeated by the Republican majority, but it ate up enough time that the Senate Health Policy Chair, Gail Harrell, she's a Stewart Republican, she wound up having to postpone a vote on the bill that was sponsored by Senator Kelly Stargell. She's a Lakeland Republican. But, all told, though, it's a momentary victory for the Democrats. This bill looks like it's going to pass when legislators convene the 2020 session in January. And that will likely set up a test. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it did get a hearing when it was sponsored last year in the Senate, but the Senate did not advance it past this committee. At this point, whether it's a revisionist history, the Senate's kind of saying, "Oh, well, we just kind of ran out of time last year during the legislative session." There seems to be some more momentum this year to hear it. The Senate has three committees scheduled to review this bill, whereas in the House it only went through one committee, and it's kind of ready for the House floor. So I think we're going to see it probably pass the Republican-led House in the month of January, once legislators convene. In the Senate, it may take a little longer time, but it does appear to have a little bit more oomph behind it this year than it did last year. I think it's going to pass, and when it does pass, it will face a test of the state's new conservative Supreme Court, which is likely to be asked to reverse the court's opinion from 30 years ago, which ruled that an earlier consent law was in violation of the state's right to privacy. We did have a little bit of sound, though. Here's Stargell introducing her bill and saying what it will do.
The bill protects minor girls who are pregnant or considered an abortion by involving at least one of their parents or legal guardians in the decision-making process. This bill also protects the fundamental right of parents to raise their children as they see fit without government intrusion. Finally, the bill addresses concern raised by the Supreme Court that judicial waiver process must be available for minors under certain circumstances, such as abuse.
Yeah, so 21 states now have parental consent laws. That's according to the Guttmacher Institute, which tracks abortion laws around the nation. But, you know, it's going to face a court test in Florida, and Democrats and abortion rights organizations see this as a real pivotal moment and part of a larger national movement to revisit the 1973 Roe versus Wade case that legalized abortion nationwide. Florida, though, you know, has had a parental notice law since voters approved one in 2004. And parental consent, while clearly a tougher standard that could endanger the right to abortion for minors, it may be something that a lot of Florida voters might support, even if it was ever put before voters. So I'm guessing that the Republican legislature may have some level of public opinion behind it on this. Parental consent may not be as starkly dividing as, say, fetal heartbeat bills, which other states have enacted that seem intended to overhaul the landscape for all women in a state. Really, it's a kind of crass political way of looking at it, but like so many things that this legislature does, the targets in this case are a largely marginalized minority, teenage girls who have, you know, little political clout. In this case, they can't even vote. The lives of many, though, could change if this consent bill becomes law. But the cold political reality is that I think it will, with a Republican majority legislature and a Republican governor, and Democrats just don't have the numbers to stop it. I don't think we'll see really any defections within the Republican ranks on this, but I think there's a strong chance that the entire Democratic caucus in the House and Senate would not stand united against this. You could have a few Democrats, not many, but a few, I think, that side with the idea of parental consent. But overall, almost the entire Democratic caucus will see this as an assault on Roe versus Wade and refuse to go along. But in the complicated world of abortion rights, a few Democrats will side with what they see as a family's right to know or something like that. But again, it's going to be up to the state Supreme Court, and maybe even more importantly, a federal court, if it gets that direction too, to decide if consent and the option of going to court for a waiver to obtain an abortion, whether that complies with the state and the U.S. Constitution.
John, you mentioned the fetal heartbeat bill, which has come up in the legislature the last few years and hasn't passed, and it would outlaw abortions after a fetal heartbeat can be detected. There's all sorts of other abortion bills that come up, including an outright ban on abortion, or what's known as the fetal pain bill, which would outlaw abortions after after what advocates say is a stage that a fetus could feel pain, which is, I guess, in dispute. But there's all sorts of abortion bills, and I guess some people would be wondering why this bill. And I think you mentioned you touched on it that this you think maybe is a more popular bill that could get broader support, that the idea of parental consent maybe resonates beyond just Republicans, that even some Democrats or independents might support this bill.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it. I think I have been told that the House, which is a very conservative chamber, will not take up anything more. Right? As far as, you know, like the fetal heart, there is a fetal heartbeat bill filed, but they are not interested in going further. But this legislation, the consent issue, seems to be something that, you know, I guess for many legislators is seen as palatable. Now again, I think there are stark dividing lines. I don't think when I talk about some Democrats siding with it, we're talking, you know, maybe two or three, not much more than that. But I think it is seen as something that with voters, maybe, you know, generally, I think many families could see increasing this role of parents from notification to consent. even though, you know, it is a dramatic change and it's going to be something that how workable it is a whole nother story. Those were some of the amendments that Democrats brought up this week was, you know, none of these counties are really in a position to adequately tell young women, here's what you have to do to get a judicial bypass if you do not want to tell your parents, if you want to come before a judge. But, you know, think about that for a, you know, a 17-year-old. That's going to be an incredibly complicated thing to try to figure out. And those are some of the real world issues that this bill opens itself up to. But I think for now, I think it's seen as kind of a mom and pop, you know, kind of situation where there's a vision of Florida families that is, you know, kind of wholesome. And that's another issue that Democrats raise is that there are some, you know, horror stories in many families and very dysfunctional families that you're putting this requirement that if a young girl becomes pregnant, she's going to have to get the consent of her parents, which could be a whole, you know, explosive situation in a household.
Well, abortion politics are always very heated, so I'm sure this will be a big issue in the 2020 legislative session. Last year, it was the Sanctuary Cities bill that was a real political lightning rod, and it seems like this year, this abortion bill is going to get a lot of attention and could be a real hot-button issue. But we're going to move on to our pick a number segment. John, you had a whopper this week, $543.2 million. You want to tell us what that's about?
Yeah, that big number are millions of dollars, and that's what the state of Florida is going to issue as a corporate income tax refund on May 1st to a sliver of companies. You know, almost half $1 billion. That's quite a windfall, but it stems from what the companies would maintain are effectively overcharges that come from the Federal Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was signed into law by President Trump and took effect in January 2018. The Senate's Finance and Tax Committee got a primer this week on the refund and how we got here. This amount first became apparent in September when state analysts pinned down the refund total. But for lawmakers, more news to this week was that this big payback may be a one-time thing, with the committee told that another major refund is not anticipated in the next budget year by the state's revenue department. No surprise, it's a complicated explanation, but Florida basically took in more than it anticipated last year, and that's because changes in federal law had the effect of broadening the amount of corporate profits that were subject to tax, although that law also lowered the tax rate and allowed for more generous bonus depreciation for companies. But the refund in Florida will go to the 1% of corporations who actually pay the state's corporate income tax, with exemptions enacted through the years, mostly under former Governor Rick Scott. They basically trimmed away everyone else who pays it. Scott, we remember, you know, he had wanted to abolish the corporate income tax, but the legislature never fully went along with him since it pulls in more than $2 billion a year. That's money that the state needs to finance the budget. But basically, it's only the biggest of Florida companies who pay it. We can't name names since tax returns are exempt from Florida's public records law, but these big companies will be pocketing a nice refund next spring, maybe, you know, just in time for some of them to share it with state politicians who are going to be campaigning for election next fall.
All right. Half $1 billion. That's not pocket change when it comes to programs in the state budget. Well, my number is $824,000. That's the amount of money Governor Ron DeSantis raised in October. That was his biggest fundraising month since he took office in January. DeSantis has been banking a good chunk of cash for his reelection bid, even though we're still a long way off from 2022. He has $3.3 million in cash on hand. The governor is raising money because he'll need it. He won the closest governor's race in Florida history last year, and he doesn't have a vast personal fortune like former Governor Rick Scott to fall back on. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy and Joseph Forzano, and thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.